Welcome. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the Bay Area Book Festival. Enjoy the conversation.
I'm John Diaz, the editorial page editor for the San Francisco Chronicle. And I want to welcome you here to the Chronicle stage, and also welcome Shane Bauer, who we're going to be talking to, the author of the new book, American Prison. And Shane obviously is a senior writer for Mother Jones, the sponsor of this event. Thank you, Mother Jones. Shane's been a senior writer for Mother Jones for about 5 years, and he started his journalism career reporting in the Middle East, and he's won a number of prestigious awards over the years. And yes, this is the same Shane Bauer who was arrested by the Iranian military when he and two of his companions were hiking along the Iraqi-Kurdistan border. He co-authored a memoir about their experience titled A Sliver of Light. Now, this book, American Prison, was listed by the New York Times and the San Francisco Chronicle as one of the 10 best of 2018. Also, former President Barack Obama said it was one of his favorite books of the year. Did you send him an autographed copy, Shane?
I don't have his address.
And so it is great to have Shane here to talk about what he experienced and what he learned as an undercover prison guard in Louisiana. Please welcome Shane Bauer.
Thank you.
Shane, for those who haven't read the book, the setup might seem almost preposterous. You know, here you are, someone who spent 2 years in an Iranian prison, 4 months of which were in solitary confinement. And isn't prison the last place in the world you would want to go undercover? Couldn't you go to a fast food joint to write about stolen wages or something? What compelled you?
Well, so when I got out of prison, I came back home. I live here in the Bay Area. And this was 2011, and, you know, I had still kind of thought that eventually I would go back to the Middle East, and that's kind of where I started my career. That's, you know, was kind of my focus. I speak Arabic. But I got home in 2011, and I happened to get back when there was a huge hunger strike happening in California prisons. There were reports of 30,000 people on hunger strike, protesting the use of long-term solitary confinement. And I had been in solitary. I had gone on hunger strike. So I was kind of just naturally drawn to this and was kind of following it, but was also, you know, going through this kind of disorienting experience of readjusting after captivity, and I was not ready to kind of jump back into work. But eventually, I start digging more into our use of solitary confinement in this country, especially in California. And I found that in California, there are thousands of people who have been in solitary confinement for more than 10 years, some for 20, 30, and even 40 years. And I start corresponding with a lot of these people and, you know, learning about their cases, how they got put in solitary, and talking to their lawyers. And I found that most of these people, actually all of them who were in solitary for indefinite terms, were not there because of, you know, the crime they were convicted of for. It was all internal disciplinary stuff. And most of them were not even in there for violent infractions in the prisons. They were there because they were considered associates of prison gangs. But when I looked at what that meant, you know, some of the evidence that was used against people to put them in solitary were like that they had Black Panther books or, you know, they were studying African-American history and stuff like that. So, you know, I kind of went deep into this. I visited Pelican Bay Prison in Northern California and wrote about that. And I just kind of got pulled in from there into the American prison system. And, you know, we have more people in prison here than any country in the world by far. And I just for years was writing about prisons. And as anybody who reports on prisons, I was kind of constantly getting frustrated with the lack of access to prisons. I was finding that often if I wanted to even just get kind of basic information, like, you know, documents that we can access through public records laws, I would have to sue the states to get them. And I had been, one of the things that I'd been interested in was private prisons, partially because there was just so little reporting on them, you know, from the inside. There was kind of, you know, every once in a while there would be a lawsuit or something and it would get some attention, but, and private prisons are kind of the most difficult to access because, you know, these laws that we have for even, you know, these public records laws that I'm talking about don't apply often to these prisons because they're not public institutions. They're private companies. They're run by private companies. So, you know, I guess I think in some ways the answer to your question is people ask me this question a lot. You know, it's like, why would you go back to a prison? But I think it's actually pretty common for people who have been imprisoned to kind of continue to engage with prisons afterwards. And for me, it kind of helped me make sense of my own experience. And then, you know, it was a few years after I got out that I had this idea to apply for a job at one of the largest private prison companies in the country. And I mean, I didn't really think through it that much, to be honest, because it was kind of a whim. I didn't really think it was going to work. You know, I didn't think they would hire me. So I just filled out their application online. You know, it was like a 20-minute process. And I didn't lie in the application. And I just sent it off, you know. And then a couple of weeks later, I was getting a bunch of interview requests and doing interviews. And I wasn't, you know, even when I was getting ready to do those interviews, I was thinking, like, how am I going to do this without lying to them? What am I going to say when they ask me, you know, about like why I want to work there? And they just didn't. They didn't ask me. They didn't ask me I want to work there. They didn't ask me about my job history. You know, nothing. It was just like, you know, how do you work with others? What do you do if your boss tells you to do something? It's just like, it could have been a Walmart interview.
Sounds like they don't have Google there either at the Corrections Corporation of America. Because Shane, you're not someone who's actually out there in the behind the scenes for all those years. I can only imagine the ethical and the logistical issues associated with going into prison undercover as a guard. I'm wondering how you and Mother Jones, your editors there, came up with those boundaries. What were the legal risks and what did you perceive to be the physical risk of going undercover as a prison guard?
The physical risk or physical?
Physical.
Physical, okay.
There's physical risk, too.
Yeah. So
at $9 an hour.
Yeah. So when I first proposed the idea to my editors, you know, they basically said, you know, fill out the application, just don't lie. That was kind of the ground rule from the beginning. You know, I don't lie. So that was, you know, at first, I think for them, it was similar to me where it was kind of like, yeah, this is such a long shot. Give it a try. But we didn't have to talk through it that much because we didn't really think it was going to work. But then once I start getting job offers, then we really kind of sat down and talked to our lawyers and, you know, made sure that I wasn't going to be breaking any laws, that we weren't setting ourselves up to get sued by the company, or that they could at least, we couldn't prevent them from suing us, but at least we wanted to prevent them from suing us successfully. And, you know, we talked about safety. We had to deal with just bureaucratic things like, you know, I have workers' comp at my job. Is that going to cover me if I get stabbed in a prison? You know, so we talked about that stuff. But then there was this whole other set of ethical questions for me beyond the kind of journalistic ethics questions of, you know, lying and stuff like that. Just having been a prisoner, you know, to go and be a guard, it was a weird position to be in, you know. And so that was something that I was kind of constantly wrestling with. There was never like any clear, it's not like I sat down in the beginning and kind of figured all this stuff out and then went in. It was a constantly kind of evolving question, you know, that I was grappling with, how to be, you know, it was strange for me to be locking people up, you know, every day. And there were times when I like one time I found a cell phone, you know, which is contraband in prison. And, you know, when I remember very clearly the moment that I found this phone, it was like under a water fountain in the prison. And, you know, if when I was a prisoner, I would have taken a phone and I would have done anything to have a phone, you know. And if I knew some other prisoner had a phone, I would never say anything about it. But now my job was to take it. And so those kind of things were like actually kind of some of the biggest ethical conundrums I had. And in some ways I kind of dealt with that by just pretty early on, just like I just kind of shut down that, you know, kind of any feelings of guilt or conflict I had. And it really changed me in a lot of ways where I just kind of became another guard, you know, just became kind of hardened and wouldn't, you know, let those kind of questions get to me after a while.
Let me ask you a little bit about the logistics. In the book, you describe going into prison every day with a pen that did audio recordings. Mm-hmm. That, you know, as there's a lot of quotes in the book and dialogue. You had a watch that also doubled as a camera. You were able to get those through. Where do you get that stuff? I thought only Dick Tracy and the CIA had that kind of a surveillance equipment.
The internet. I mean, I just Googled like spy watches, and there's like tons of websites. They were like $30.
There's your pro tip of the day.
Yeah, they were like made in China. They were actually, took me a while to figure out how to use them because the instruction books were just like indecipherable, and I had to just practice and try to figure out how to use them. But I felt that it was important to use these things because I wanted, you know, when I sat down and wrote this thing, I wanted it to be, I didn't want to have to rely on my memory. You know, I couldn't really take notes. In training, I could a little bit, but on the job, you know, I could run into the bathroom sometimes and scribble things down. But so the book, you know, everything that is between quotation marks is exactly what people said, you know, and that was important to me to kind of, one, you know, alleviate that doubt for the reader, you know, it's like, is this really, is he exaggerating? Because this stuff was like so extreme that I was seeing and the stuff people were saying, and I just really wanted it to be 100% accurate.
You know, the screening process that you describe in the book and here is so perfunctory that it almost seems crazy.
Yeah.
In fact, in your book, you quote a trainer telling you and your fellow cadets, people say, we'll hire anybody, which seems to be about the case. Do you think the environment at the Wynn Correctional Center would be different if there was more vetting and more training of the guards?
Well, just to finish that quote, she said that if you're breathing and you have a driver's license and you're willing to work, then we're willing to hire you. So that was the standard. Yeah, I do think it would be different. You know, this town, you know, the average income of a family is like $27,000 a year. It's a very poor part of the country. People who are taking the job, you know, I don't think anybody that I met was kind of taking the job because they were like sadists, you know, they were desperate people, you know, that would work at in a prison for $9 an hour, you know? So it was a lot of single moms, that needed health insurance for their kids. It was, so it's a lot of kind of just 18, 19 year olds at high school. And then there was this kind of set of people who had been in either in corrections or in law enforcement that were kicked out of their last jobs because of brutality, and they couldn't get a job somewhere else except these private prison companies, and they were willing to take these low paying jobs because they just couldn't get other jobs. Like there's a guy who told me about how he had worked in a juvenile detention center in Texas, and he uppercutted a 16-year-old kid and shattered his jaw, you know. So this is kind of where he ends up. And same with doctors, you know, a lot of medical malpractice. You know, so what happens is these guards are getting like $9 an hour, and they, you know, they're having to figure out other ways to make ends meet, you know, so they're bringing in drugs. And I mean, that's how it gets in every prison. It's not just a private prison issue. This is the main way the drugs and contraband and weapons come in, is through guards. And it was kind of one of the main themes of training that they were always telling us, you know, you're going to start this job, you're going to realize you're not making enough money, and the prisoners are going to remind you that you're not making enough money. And some of them make more money than you do, you know, and you're going to be tempted, you know, and people were. I mean, it was happening all the time.
Let's talk a little bit more about the guards. You document a lot of examples of guards behaving badly, either beating inmates when they're out of view of the cameras. There was one instance that you had a guard who admitted using actual inmates to train as bloodhounds.
Yeah.
And how much of this do you think is the influence? You mentioned that you don't think people necessarily go in as sadists, but how much of this is the influence of the prison environment itself? And how much is it a matter of the people who apply for these guard jobs are attracted in part, maybe not sadists, but by the violence and the domination?
Well, I think that actually what is more common is just that the prison turns people into these, you know, kind of some of them into sadists. And people just get so... they become so kind of bitter and hardened. And, you know, I saw that happening to myself. That was really probably the most surprising thing about this whole project, was just seeing how easy, you know, I was going in. I wasn't really going in to write about what it's like to be a prison guard. That was just my way in. And I thought, you know, I'll just kind of just be easygoing and stay out of people's way. And, it's, you know, being in that environment, and you're making so little money, you know, this was not so much my issue. You know, I had another job, but like these people, they're making $9 an hour. There's no reason for them to kind of, do, you know, all the things they're supposed to do. They're not going to get fired, you know, so they just kind of are just taking up time. But you find yourself in this situation where, you know, you maybe be critical of the company, and really every guard there that I spoke to was, they hated the company. The prisoners and guards all hated the company, and they would bond on that. You know, they would talk about it. But at the same time, you know, you're working in a unit with like 350 prisoners, and there's like one other guard there with you, and all the prisoners are constantly frustrated because, you know, their programs are getting cut because there isn't enough staff. Like, school's cut that day. They're getting lunch 3 hours late. Their recreation time's canceled because there's no guards to send them out. So they're mad, and you're the one who's interacting. You know, you're their point of contact to the whole system. So it just, you know, it sets... It made me think of, like, soldiers, you know? Like, you're in a war... especially when people were, you know, conscripted, and you're just finding yourself in some country you know nothing about, and you're fighting some other poor people, you know, and like you may have some idea that, like, why am I doing this? You might be critical of it, but at the same time, when you're on the front line, you know, it becomes very personal, and you're just you just get thrown into this situation where you're competing for dominance and power. And, you know, I think I saw a lot of guards come in, and they would, this is a generalization, but, you know, I feel like in overall they would go one of two ways. Some would come in and they would kind of say, like, you know, I want to be a human being, you know, with these prisoners and treat them well. And then they would either, do that, but just feel like kind of guilty about locking them up and all this stuff, and they just couldn't deal with it, and they would quit. Or they would go to the other side, you know, and just kind of become hardened, get wrapped up in their petty battles, and, you know, be one of these people that have been there for 10 years and are just lashing out, you know.
I thought one of the more fascinating elements of your book was your evolution in terms of your relationship with the inmates. That some of them, obviously, as you describe, are pretty good con men. And I was struck by this passage where you talked about how you saw and recognized yourself changing. Say, I see conspiracies brewing. Things I used to view as harmless transgressions, I now view as personal attacks. When a physically disabled man doesn't leave the shower in time for count, I am certain he is testing me, trying to break me down, to dominate me. You go on, I don't care about the rules per se. Many of them seem arbitrary, but I become obsessed with the notion that people are breaking them in front of me just to whittle away at my will. Is there any way a person can keep their humanity either as a guard or inmate inside a prison?
You know, I want to say no, but at the same time, but people do. You know, I mean, I think, like, it's easy to kind of... there's a certain way that your humanity is totally eroded, I think, both as a guard and a prisoner. Prison is just... It's such an inhumane place. And it's so volatile. It's, you know, it's so hard to kind of... even gestures like... You know, sharing or giving in prison can be dangerous. You know, there's a lot of exploitation in so many ways in prison. But at the same time, you know, the opposite exists. You know, I like an example is, you know, sexual violence in prison is a huge issue, and it's just really in many ways I saw it overlooked by the, you know, by the prison administration. So you have a situation that's common in prison is a kind of like sexual slavery type of situation where some prisoners will, you know, sometimes choose to or just be taken by stronger men. And these men kind of are offering them protection in exchange for sex. And, you know, the guards would talk about this like so the people on the, you know, bottom end of that equation are they call them punks, and the guards are just like, you know, it's like, oh, that guy's a punk, you know, and there's no kind of sense that like that should be stopped, you know. It's just a part of, they see it as a part of the culture. But also, you know, I worked in the mailroom for a week and I had to read letters coming in, and there were so many letters that were from prisoners who had been in this prison that were transferred or got free, and they were writing to their lovers in the prison, you know, and it was just like, this is not a kind of relationship of exploitation. You know, there was love letters, you know, and, there are so many kind of, types of camaraderie and these kind of moments of connection that happen, including between, prisoners and guards at times.
You also write in the book about how the effect of this experience on your personal relationships, namely with your wife, Sarah. As you write, she says, I'm changing. All I talk about with her is the prison, and the way I talk about it makes her uncomfortable. You know, you talk about how your dialogue with your conversations with your wife suddenly became whatever was the drama of the day within the prison.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was there for 12 hours a day. It totally consumed my life, and I found myself, you know, getting, it's like I was doing basically what I'm critical of, kind of police and just people in this world of corrections and law enforcement doing, which is like, nobody understands me. I can't relate to anybody, and you know, it's a really dangerous kind of slope to go down. But, you know, was in this world that was so intense for 12 hours a day. And then I'm kind of, it's like you're going from like a war situation to the home life just throughout the day back and forth, you know? And it made me kind of alienated from, you know, my relationships and the world around me. And this is, you know, this is a common issue. Prison guards have like super high rate of suicide. PTSD is like higher than soldiers, you know, who are coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. So it's something I had to deal with. And, you know, I was having nightmares. I was drinking a lot, to be honest. Just trying to kind of, you know, cope.
Did you socialize with the other guards after hours?
No, I didn't. I mean, there were a couple of reasons. One is that I just did not want to hang out with them more than the 12 hours I was hanging out with them already. But also, that was one of those kind of ethical questions that I just felt that, I was writing about these people, and they didn't know I was a journalist, and it just felt like getting into their personal lives was kind of a step too far. I just wanted to kind of keep it at the job, you know. But I did. I tried to kind of make friends in the town, but that also was weird because I couldn't really tell them that much about myself, and you know, you can't have a real friendship where you're just like hiding so much from people. So that didn't go very far either. It would mostly just be like shooting pool with people like at the bar by my house.
I think one of the really important takeaways of this book, one of the things that you endeavor on, is to put these private prisons in context. And if you look at the history of incarceration in America, you weave a lot of that history into American prison and show that in many ways what we have in these private prisons is an extension of slavery. Yeah. A source of cheap or even free labor. You have the cotton fields, you have the sugar plantations that were part of prisons. Inmate leasing was certainly a part of it. It seems that one of the only changes as we look at the for-profit prisons with what we've seen, you know, post-Civil War, is that the inmates themselves have become the commodity. Right. They're no longer they're profiting by the work they do, but just by their very presence. In fact, you have an example of an inmate that you wrote a lot about named Corner Store, who was held for a year after being eligible for release because Louisiana law basically said unless you had an address to go to in the state, you're not getting out. So he stayed an extra year at $12,000. So we've basically gone from exploiting the labor of these human beings to simply exploiting their very existence.
Yeah, yeah. I would say that, you know, rather than the private prison grew out of slavery, I would say the prison system generally did. And so in the book, I try to trace a kind of set up in these like alternating chapters, which is, you know, one will be of my undercover experience and then it'll go to kind of historical chapter. Essentially, I'm trying to trace the role of profit and incarceration from the American Revolution up to the present. And that research was just so shocking and revealing to me. I was constantly, constantly shocked by what I was finding. But, you know, I think I often am asked about, you know, I think there's an assumption today that private prisons, that profit is kind of the driver of mass incarceration, which I don't believe is true. Private prisons are really actually a pretty small percentage, like 8% of the prison population. You know, I don't think police are out in the street arresting people because the private prison system is going to get money. That's about so many other things, you know, economic inequality, racism. There's just major problems with prosecution. You know, you can just go on forever. But through much of our history, I do think that profit was a major motivator. You know, if you look at the South, for example, like before the Civil War, the prisons were, and actually throughout the country, the prisons were essentially factories. They were like cotton factories. And the South was opening up prisons to kind of take away some of the monopoly of textiles production from the North. And they were using prison labor to produce textiles with the cotton that slaves were picking. And then they were creating they were also using prisons to subsidize the slave system by creating like subsidized clothing for slaves, shoes. And then after the Civil War, you know, there were slave owners that essentially, you know, leased the prison populations from the states and used them in much the same way that they were using slaves, before emancipation, putting them to work on cotton fields, in mines, you know, building railroads. And that, you know, probably the most shocking thing that I found in my historical research was that that system of convict leasing was more deadly than slavery. The death rate was on par with the Soviet gulags. We're talking some states 25% a year. Of prisoners are dying because, you know, the prisoners were, unlike you know, in slavery, where slave owners saw these people as their property and investments, they were now just leasing numbers, you know. So if somebody, there's this famous quote that you find in this historical literature, where this man said, one dies, get another, you know. You're leasing a number from the state, so they'll just keep that number, you know, keep replacing it. But, you know, one of the kind of surprising things that I found, and actually what set me onto this kind of historical journey, was that the founder of the company that I was working for, the Corrections Corporation of America, he started his career in Texas in the 1970s running a prison cotton plantation that was the size of Manhattan. And so he had prisoners picking cotton from dawn to dusk. He lived in a plantation house. He had what were called houseboys. They were prisoners that were serving him and his family. You know, he was living a life that was just utterly reminiscent of slavery. And he was, I mean, he worked in Arkansas, and he was actually bringing in money. He's running these plantations at a profit, but the money was going to the state. You know, this is not a private enterprise. And he was really the last person to be running these southern kind of labor camps profitably before we saw this major change in the country where our prison population just skyrocketed. And that was when we kind of switched the system from this kind of prison labor system where we're making money through labor to just warehousing people, you know, because we just had so many prisoners that we had to warehouse them. And then he and a couple other guys started this new company, the Corrections Corporation of America, which was, as you said, you know, instead of profiting from the labor, they were using the prisoners themselves as commodities, and the states were paying them just to warehouse these people, and they were, you know, on the New York Stock Exchange.
You mentioned, Shane, that once, you know, your Mother Jones article came out, that you received a lot of correspondence from inmates and guards across the country at private prisons. Are you convinced that what you saw at Wynn and described so poignantly in your book is typical?
You know, I think in some ways every prison is different, and there's a different, it's like its own kind of internal world. But at the same time, you know, after I left that job, I spent a year before I even published the article, and I did a lot of research on, you know, reading lawsuits and things like that. And I was seeing a lot of the same issues, you know. Healthcare is a major issue, lack of healthcare, security. You know, prisoners were suing, you know, basically saying that the prison was not secure because they were, you know, prioritizing profit and either not hiring enough security or, you know, underpaying them. So these issues were common. There's, you know, Department of Justice studies that kind of bore out these issues too, and were showing that that healthcare, kind of rehabilitative programs, and security were worse in the private prisons.
When we talked on the phone a couple of weeks ago, you basically said this system of for-profit prisons is just not reformable. Explain.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so these companies, they don't have a huge margin of profit. You know, there's their whole reason that they exist is because they save the state's money. But the way that they save money, the way that they make money, is by doing it cheaper. And the way they do it cheaper is by cutting corners. You know, so once they, it's like if you regulate them and start, you know, stop cutting corners, then their whole reason for existing, they're going to lose that margin of profit. So it's kind of built into the system that you're going to have these issues. And, you know, I also want to be clear that the public prisons throughout the country are really bad. I mean, this is not, like, that's not the goal. And in some ways, I would say that private prisons are kind of a symptom of the problem of mass incarceration, because we have so many people in prison that states are, it costs so much money. You know, there's kind of a myth that the prison system is making money for states, but it actually costs tons of money. And unlike in the past when it did make money for states, but today it's cost so much money. So as long as we have this many people in prison, the states are going to be looking for ways to keep locking people up for cheaper. And, you know, it's always going to come back to the question of these terrible conditions.
And it's unbelievable how cheap it is. It Wynn, a couple weeks after, after you left Wynn, the company that owned it, CCA, withdrew from its contract. Yet another contractor came in right away, scooped it up, and actually the reimbursement per day per prisoner went from $34 a day to $24 a day.
Yeah, yeah.
Let me ask you, there is some hope on the horizon. 3 years ago, President Obama's Justice Department announced that it was going to phase out putting federal inmates in private prisons. Then a little something changed on November 8th, 2016. Besides that company's stock going up 50% right away.
Yeah.
And the Trump administration not only reversed that policy of phasing out private prisons, but now they're being widely used in detention for immigrants. Of course, there's some Democrats out there on the campaign trail, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, who are talking about abolishing private prisons, at least for on the federal level. But nothing's really going to change under Donald Trump's watch.
Yeah, and just to be clear, that private prison companies were running immigrant detention centers under Obama also. And actually, when Obama had made that announcement, after he decided to stop using private prisons federally, he also granted a $1 billion contract to the Corrections Corporation of America for an immigrant detention center. I think before Trump became president, there was a sense that there was this kind of like bipartisan thing that was happening where, there was somewhat of consensus in government that we have been going in the wrong direction, that we need to have less people in prison. Jeff Sessions just really felt like a throwback. It felt like the war on drugs, like everybody recognized that was a mistake, for example. Jeff Sessions is not, he kind of brought all that stuff back. There's still, the weird thing about our criminal justice system is we have so many of them. We basically have 51. We have the federal system, and then every state has its own. So it's not always that, there can be kind of changes in a positive direction in some states, while federally it's bad, and vice versa. There can be new prisons being built while the federal government is cutting them. I think this is it was an issue in 2016. Both Clinton and Sanders were saying they were going to abolish private prisons. It's come up again. I hope that they go beyond that. That's just an issue that there's very little disagreement about, I think. I don't think there's a lot of people that are kind of feel that we need to fight for private prisons. But, we're still at a place where in some ways, I'm heartened that there is a lot more discussion about prisons and criminal justice in this country. We're talking about drug reform and things like that. But we also, I think it's important to understand that, if we abolish private prisons, if we decriminalize drugs, if we let everybody out of prison who has been in for drug offenses, we'll still be the most incarcerated country in the world, and if we let out nonviolent offenders, we'll still be the most incarcerated country in the world. So we really, like, the real work is kind of thinking about how we're punishing and how we're dealing with these things that, with violent crime, and what are the kind of deeper issues behind this stuff.
You all should know that Shane's work is definitely having an impact on the political process. There is a bill in Sacramento, Assembly Bill 32, that would phase out private prisons in California. I was talking to the author a couple weeks ago, Rob Bonta, from the East Bay, and he was citing your work as part of the evidence. Amazingly, California still has 1,400 inmates at a private prison in Arizona. In the past few years, we don't now, but we had inmates in Mississippi and Oklahoma. And especially given that, I would think that maintaining family connections is so important to rehabilitation. Even Arizona is unaffordable. It's too distant for a lot of inmates' families. Did you see evidence of that in Louisiana?
Yeah, this is the thing a lot of people don't understand is, you know, in California there was, you know, the state was under court order to lower its prison population. But the way it did that was sending prisoners to private prisons around the country. And they weren't in Louisiana, but I did meet the prison that I was in. It was really breaking down while I was there, and the company sent guards from other prisons. So I met people who worked in these prisons that had California inmates. What they'll do is they'll send different prison gangs to different prisons. So, like, you know, you'll have some state that is full of, like, Sereños from L.A., you know, in, like, Missouri or something. And there was a guard who, the prison I was in actually surprisingly didn't have any prison gangs. It also was not racially segregated, unlike California, which is hyper racially segregated in the prison system. And the guard that was in one of these prisons that had the California prisoners said that he preferred having prison gangs because they, like, enforced their own discipline. And it kind of took, he felt that it took some of the weight off the guard. So in some ways, they're kind of like leaning on these gangs to kind of enforce, you know, their own rules on the prison population.
I want to get to your audience questions in just a minute. But first, Shane, I had to ask you about near the end of your book where you write about after you had left the prison, you actually went to a shareholder meeting of the company that had run that prison. You bought one share for $30-something and asked a bunch of questions and just got a bunch of platitudes, talked about suicide and everything. And you write about that experience. Speaking of the executives of this CoreCivic, they convince themselves with remarkable ease that they are in the business of punishment because it makes the world better, not because it makes them rich.
Yeah. That was a really bizarre experience. I had wanted to, like, interview these corporate executives. I've been trying forever, and none of them would respond to me. So I bought a share because they're all there. You know, the board is all there. So they have an annual shareholder meeting in Nashville, which is where their corporate headquarters is. And so I went, and, you know, it's really just, like, it's this kind of pro forma meeting. You know, the only other shareholders that were there that were not members of the company were activists. You know, there's not really individuals that hold share in these private prison companies. I mean, many of you probably do through your mutual funds, but it's not that somebody is like, okay, I'm going to invest in CCA, you know. So, I was there, and they were showing, there was no mention of the fact that, for example, the Obama decision to pull their private prisons. They showed some videos of, you know, prisoners smiling and talking about how they're sending them back to society, better people. And, you know, so I asked questions, some of these activists asked questions, you know, they were critical. And at the end, the chair, you know, got up and he gave this kind of speech and he said, you know, I'm really want to say that I'm grateful for the people, you know, who work in these prisons and are sending our offenders back to the world, you know, better equipped. And he was like, there's critics in every industry, you know, you're going to run into that anywhere. He was like, I used to work at Bridgestone and they even criticized us. And he kind of laughed. And I found out, I looked into it later, and the criticism that he was referring to was that Bridgestone is using child labor in Liberia. You know, so he's like, that's his example of how ridiculous, you know, criticism is. It was just so surreal. You know, it just felt like so utterly removed. I don't even know how many people have been to their prisons. You know, they're just like, it's so easy when you're that far removed to kind of tell yourself a story that helps you sleep at night. And meanwhile, you're making millions of dollars, you know.
Let's go to some audience questions. If you raise your hand, we'll get a microphone. I'll be glad to do it.
Hi. Speaking of the humanitarian side of people that you saw, I just read a petition from Decarcerate Louisiana, a huge several-page petition full of humanitarianism in that they were exposing the conditions through in several Louisiana prisons, and I don't think they were the private ones, but I don't know. And they had all kinds of suggestions for how things could be more human and better, and they signed it. Could you, do you know about
this? I didn't know about that, no. But you know, the other prisons, Louisiana, at least when I was there, was the most incarcerated place in the entire world. I think now it's like Kansas or something. It's a different state. But you know, the prison, like the maximum security prison in Louisiana, Angola, I write about it, the history of that place in my book, and it was a slave plantation, you know, and it was run... It was after slavery, somebody bought it, and he leased all of the state's prisoners, and he lived on the plantation and just put the prisoners to work on his plantation. It's still a plantation, you know, and there's a rodeo there every year where prisoners, it's open to the public. Prisoners will play games like where they put a poker chip on a bull's head and prisoners try to get the chip off its head, and whoever wins gets like $100. You know, I mean, there's not like a good prison in Louisiana, you know, it's just, it's pretty bad all around.
Let's get another question. I'll head toward the back, so we'll be equal opportunity here. Did I see a hand here? Here we go.
Thank you. I was curious how the process works. If you could describe how somebody moves or it gets assigned to a private prison versus the public prison,
yeah,
how that actually works.
In Louisiana, my understanding was that it was, you know, fairly random. It was more based on kind of security level. So people will be assigned, like the prison I was in was a medium security prison. So they might be assigned to a medium security prison, and some of those were public and some were private, and it was kind of random how they, you know, went there. But in California, the companies have clauses in their contract that exempt them from having to take prisoners with serious medical conditions or mental health issues. You know, so that will kind of somewhat determine who goes there. But these points are important because, you know, the prison is saying that they're saving taxpayers' money. But at the same time, you know, these prisoners that cost more money, they're not taking these prisoners that cost more money. So that's getting put back into the kind of public system where, which, you know, the taxpayers are paying for it. So it's kind of these hidden kind of costs.
Let's get another question. Yes.
So for the history of slavery in America chapters that you dealt with.
Yeah.
How did you conduct that very detailed research? Because you synthesized this fairly dense kind of text in history. Yep. Who did you consult? Did you speak to academics on this?
Yeah, it was a lot of academic research. You know, a lot of news archives I went through. I found there were no... I couldn't find a single memoir, for example, by a prisoner who had been in prisons that early. So there were some memoirs by guards that I found, you know, kind of reports. The prisons would do annual reports every year. And, you know, a lot of those reports were essentially like reports on cotton production. So it was really a mix of kind of primary research and academics who had done some of that research before. But, you know, it's cited in there, and there's a really long kind of bibliography, and a lot of these, I mean, the history is really, there's so much, you know, there's so much that has not really been kind of dug into. And, like when I was doing the research, I would kind of get glimpses of these other veins, you know, of that past, especially that period of, you know, prisons that coexisted with slavery and the kind of period afterwards. There's just so much farther to go, I think.
Do we have a question over in this area? Someone have a question? Here we go.
It occurs to me that, in fact, our mass incarceration system has a really definite economic function, and that is it answers unemployment. Did you see that? Do you feel that?
I don't think, I mean, we have, look around us. I mean, we have homeless people everywhere. I mean, I do think there's a, there's clearly an economic, a major economic component to why so many people are going in prison. I mean, people who are poor and desperate will do what they can to survive. And I'm not saying that's why everybody goes into prison. There's many different types of people and reasons that people end up in prison, but economic inequality is a huge one. But you know, I wouldn't say it's an answer.
We're over here, Shane.
This is a double question, which in my experience is kind of risky, but the first sort of blends into the second. The first one has to do with both these questions have to do with the state of California's prison system. I'm interested in your take on the potential role of the prison guards union in possibly improving the situation. And the second question has to do with media access. As a journalist yourself, you're up against this problem of freedom of information challenges and struggles. And my recollection is that within the last 10, certainly within the last 20 years, under some Republican governor or other, there was actually legislation passed that more or less kicked the press out of the prisons. And is there any potential for changing that for the better?
So I'll ask your second question first. So I think what you're referring to is that California, they call it the Charlie Manson law or something like that, where they won't allow journalists to interview specific prisoners. So I can't go and request an interview with a certain prisoner. The prisoner will provide me with a prisoner to interview. And what I saw when I was reporting on California prisons, for example, when I went to Pelican Bay, which is a supermax prison where people are held in long-term solitary confinement. And they were giving the journalist the same inmate who was the guy who was about to get out, you know, and like, this guy's not going to take any risks, you know, he's trying to get out of solitary confinement. So I would get around that by writing to prisoners, which took a lot of time. And a lot of journalists don't have that much time, but, I would correspond with prisoners. So I would kind of get these other, you know, stories. At the same time, I will say that California is better than most states with its public records laws with the prison system. You know, you can get information from it, but getting into the prisons you can get into the prisons too, but you know, you get like a scripted tour for a half hour. It's not that useful, honestly. As far as the guards union, I would say, are one of the biggest obstacles to prison reform in California. They have fought against, you know, they infamously fought against attempts to have women prisoners unshackled during childbirth. You know, it's like these guys, the solitary confinement's a big one. There was a big lawsuit in California where, you know, trying to change the use of long-term solitary confinement. And the guards union asked to be a defendant on that lawsuit. You know, like they were trying to get into the lawsuit to fight it. So they're a really draconian force. You know, I mean, it's in some ways the opposite problem of what I was seeing in Louisiana, where, you know, the guards were like, here they make a lot of money. You know, there they're making $9 an hour. I don't know what the starting wage is here, but it's really high. You know, I don't think the answer to prison problems is like for guards to unionize. That's not, you know, yeah, I don't know.
A final quick question, Shane, what are you going to do for your next book? How do you top this as far as adrenaline and intrigue?
Well, I'm not necessarily trying to top this in that way. I'm currently working on a long project about, American involvement in Syria, very different project. It's not undercover. And I'm kind of, you know, trying to deal with all the ways that Americans have been involved in that war, from the CIA and the military to kind of private citizens who went and joined militias there, people who joined ISIS, and, you know, just kind of our role in that war. So that's kind of what I'm doing now.
Please join me in thanking Shane Bauer, author of American Prison.
I
highly recommend it. A terrific read. Shane, thank you so much.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Bay Area Book Festival. For more information and podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.